Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your monthly horror podcast chatting to the best breaking talent the genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and in this month's episode, I'm chatting to Australian film director Ben Young. Over the course of the interview we do, we talk about a whole lot of different things, but the main focus being his latest feature film, Extinction, as well as his feature directorial debut, which came out last year, Hounds of Love. It came out to massive praise, well-deserved praise, I would say. We talk about different aspects of those two films, as well as talking about the challenges of the kind of comparing and contrasting working with a big budget film like he was doing with Extinction compared to indie filmmaking like he was doing with Hounds of Love, as well as working with material that he wrote himself on Hounds of Love as opposed to working with material written by somebody else on Extinction. Yeah, we delve into a whole bunch of stuff like that. We delve into the minor controversy that Hounds of Love caused in Australia. We delve into whether he certainly views the movie as more of a psychological thriller than naturally a horror, even though it's got that tag. And, you know, I would welcome any comments below the line if you, what's your thoughts? If you've seen the movie, what's your thoughts? Do you think it's a horror? It's a matter of debate. And we debate various things in the interview about horror, his take on horror. And yeah, I think it's a really fascinating interview, and I hope you think the same. Anyway, one quick note before we go into the interview. Well, I recorded this back in late June. So at that point, Extinction had not arrived on Netflix yet. It was not until late July it came out on Netflix. So at this point, I had not seen the movie. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed conducting it. And now we go on to my guest, Ben. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Hi, thank you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think the first thing we should probably talk about is you've got a new movie coming out just soon. Extinction?
I do. That is coming out on Netflix on the 27th of July, I believe. And so I imagine a trailer for that will come out in the next few weeks.
It's somewhat of an all-star cast. It's got Michael Pena, Lizzie Kaplan, Mike Coulter of Luke Cage fame.
Yep.
Got a bunch of
Israel Bouchard, Emma Booth, Lex Shrapnel.
Yeah.
And Little Lily, who plays Emma and Lex's daughter in the film. She's a young Wonder Woman in the last Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah. There doesn't seem to be, looking about, there doesn't seem to be much detail on the plot out there, that Michael Pena's character, Peter, has a recurring nightmare about his family being taken away from him, which becomes into reality as the planet is invaded by an evil force, I presume, some sort of alien force.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's pretty much it. There's been it's all been a very secretive process because there's a lot of twists and turns in the film that are really going to act as spoilers. And so the premise that you put forward is a pretty accurate one, and I'm reluctant to say much more for fear of my tongue slipping and giving away some pretty cool things. I will say that it is a very different film to my last one. Hounds of Love. You know, Hounds of Love was certainly an art house film made for the festival audiences, and this one is very much more a popcorn thriller.
So it's more in the blockbuster arena, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's supposed to be more of a fun film. And so it doesn't get, I mean, it's dark and challenging in places, but it's certainly not at the same level of Hounds of Love. And it's a lot more action-packed. Hounds of Love was really based on the psychological relationships between the, and while this one certainly has interpersonal conflict and relationships going on, it's a real action piece. There's a lot of action going on, quite the opposite to Hounds of Love.
It seems that it had quite a complicated journey to get to screen. It was initially going to be released by Universal Pictures in January, and then that suddenly was pulled from release, and then Netflix picked it up in February for a release in July 27th.
All of this is true. And if you're familiar with the story of Annihilation, it's a very similar story to what we went through. But the big issue that we had is, to put it in perspective, I finished the VFX last Friday, and the film was supposed to come out in January. So that was part of the problem. Universal had given us a really wonderful slot, and there was no way that we were ever going to make it, because the film just got bigger than Ben-Hur as far as the scale of it went. It needed a lot more VFX than anyone was expecting, because the world was so much bigger and we liked what we were doing so much that we didn't want to skimp out and make the film less than it could be. And so it was a very amicable decision by everybody to, you know, lose the Universal slot in January and wait a little bit longer and go with Netflix.
I mean, I can see that why you would want to make the picture that is absolutely the best you can, and not like kind of shorten down everything just to rush for a particular release date.
Absolutely. But Universal were great. Like, there was no conflict in any of this. They completely understood where we were coming from, and they ultimately wanted the best for the movie, and they didn't want to put anything else, put something out in January that wasn't going to be of par either. And so it was just a really kind of, it was a win-win situation for everyone in the end, which was really good.
Is it very different? Obviously, this is a bigger Hollywood production. You've mainly worked in Australia. And also you're not directing your own material. I know the many of your shorts and Hounds of Love was written by yourself. Are those things different, both directing other people's material and also the scale of the production compared to what you've previously been accustomed to?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And the short answer is yes. It is a lot harder directing material that you haven't written. Because just to put it in perspective, this script has been in development for 5 years, and there's been other directors attached to it over the time, and there's been a lot of producers involved over the way who all had their own vision for the film. And I only got involved in October of 2016, and then we were shooting it by February of, we were in pre-production by February of 2017. And so it is very difficult when you're the new kid on the block and you're the one who's supposed to come up with the vision for everything. But you've had so many other people who've just spent so much longer thinking about it. So they obviously do have their own ideas. And so the hardest thing is, I think, finding faith in yourself, because when you get excited by something, you go, oh, I'm going to do it like this. And you get a bunch of blank faces stare at you and go, oh, really? I always thought it would be more like this. Then you can't help but sit there and go, oh God, am I wrong? These guys have been thinking about it so much longer than me. So maybe they're right. Maybe they thought of my idea and they're wrong. And it's just so much easier, because when you write, it's so much, I mean, writing is horrible and it's incredibly difficult. But I write it very visually. And even the way that I put it on the page is I write it out as simple as it could translate to screen as possible. So I leave a line roughly where I imagine every cut would be, and I really imagine it exactly as I'm seeing it. Mm-hmm. And so it gets a lot simpler. Like by the time we got to Hounds of Love, I saw the whole movie inside and out. So I had an answer to every question that was honest and was real. And so if an actor ever came up and said, you know, how about I do this? I'd just go, no, well, you can't do that because the intention of the scene is this, you know, and you just know inside and out. And you know, when it's your material, well, you're right. You know, sometimes people can come, often, by the way, people come up and they've got better ideas that make, that you know, strengthen your vision. But you know what your vision is. And so it makes it a lot easier to recognize the good ideas from the bad idea when it's your own material. And so, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I found it very different in that sense. Scale-wise, just to put it in perspective, outside of painting out some things in Hounds of Love, like we had a lot of modern light switches in the house in the film, and we painted all of those out. So, but apart from that, there was virtually no special effects or VFX in the film at all. Oh. Whereas in Extinction, I think there's over 800 VFX shots. And so all I'd ever done, I shot two shots in a green screen in my entire life before this film. And now we were building sets that were entirely surrounded by 180 degrees of blue screen. We use blue screen on this one. And so that was very different. But as far as the process of, you know, of being on set every day went, it was virtually exactly the same. It's, you run into all the same problems, and which is mostly time, but yeah, the actual shooting of it was pretty similar.
Yeah. So is it very different dealing with, you know, I mean, obviously Hounds of Love is very much rooted in reality. It's, you know, there's physical things there. Is it very, very different filming that, you know, where you've not got kind of, you know, a thing in front of you that you're, I mean.
I don't know exactly what you're asking. And the answer is, it is a lot harder because, you know, I grew up in Western Australia in the 80s when Hounds of Love was set. And there's also, all you need to do is jump on Google Image and Google Australia 1980s. And you get 100 authentic photographs that has come up, that have come up. And so you know exactly what it looked like. And so your bullshit shit meter goes off every time you see something that isn't honest. But when you're making a science fiction film, it has to be original. So it can't look like anything that's ever been done before. And so there's that constant fear of, oh, is what I'm doing authentic to this world? And is this world authentic to this story? And so, yeah, so it's a huge, hugely different process.
Was there, when you were making Extinction, I know you don't want to give too much away about the plot, and I totally understand, I totally respect that, but was there, you were saying about like making sci-fi worlds looking unique. Was there any kind of touchstones or things that you had in mind of other sci-fi pictures? Alien 2001, you know, anything?
Yeah, there certainly was. There was two. And you're not even going to believe me when I tell you, because those films are nothing like this film. But the two that I touched on most were Her and Gattaca. And not because our film was anything like them, but they were two science fiction films that had their very own distinctive look. Because if you grab science fiction just generally as a genre, you could almost take one character out of another and stick them in the other, because, you know, people copy each other so much. And so my big rule was, I don't want this to look like anything that we've seen before. And so those two films I put on pedestals just because I think that they both aesthetically are really unique in their vision. And so that's what I wanted to do, even though genre wise, we are much more action packed. Those two films were kind of pinnacles as far as I was concerned, because they were so unique in their vision. But also both of those films, you know, in regards to story, they had a very strong emotional core to them. It wasn't just about the actions and explosions. There was a lot of character dynamics in them, and there's a lot of character dynamics in Extinction as well. And so we modeled that a little bit on those films, even though, you know, anyone who sees Extinction probably won't see any similar.
Yeah. Okay.
They were the ones that we were discussing.
Okay. I mean, they are pretty unique looking films, and both excellent pictures. And I agree with you that there is a lot of that, both in science fiction and horror. There is a lot of recycling and a lot of
Absolutely.
You know, like the genre kind of eating itself, you know, and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, another one that I used as a big reference was Arrival, because I just thought that firstly, I used that as a reference for cinematography, but secondly, the look of that spaceship was just so unique. I mean, this is obviously a very different species to us, and so it's got a very alien technology, and so their spacecraft would probably look completely the opposite of what we imagine them to, and so I just loved in that how they just had those very dome shapes. Like simple ships, and so that was another one that I put on the unique pedestal.
On differences as well, is it any different in terms of interacting with actors on a picture like that, and in terms of like them already being established stars compared to a lot of people not being established stars in the work you've done previously, or is it just all pretty much the same?
No, really, really good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before, and so I'm going to enjoy answering it. It's really different because it's a lot more technical. So with Hounds of Love, I could pretty much do whatever I wanted because we were in a house that we had, you know, rented for 6 months or however long it was, and everything, you know, no matter which direction the backgrounds, the actors walked in, I could make it work visually. But with this one, there was so much technical stuff that was going to be special effects. It was very hard to demonstrate to the actors the level of emotion I needed them to put into it, because of course they didn't see what the threat was a lot of the time, because it was something which was going to be in digitally. And so I often, and certainly until I did this movie, I often don't think of acting as acting. I think of it as reacting. Like the best actors listen to the person they're opposite and react to that. And if, you know, no matter what the delivery is, they just take it as honest and have a genuine reaction to it. And so when you're asking actors to react off something which isn't there, it's really difficult. So that was hard. As far as working with higher profile actors, I would say there's zero difference. They were all just as enthusiastic as the Australian actors that I worked with, and you know, willing to work just as hard. I think that no matter where you are in the world, to make it to the level where you're working at the top of your game, you have to love what you're doing. And so I didn't have actors rolling their eyes or, you know, getting annoyed that I was doing another take or whatever, because they just wanted the best for the film. So no, they were all lovely. Yeah. And, you know, and I should also emphasize that before I cast anybody in the film, I did a lot of research about what they were like as people.
Right.
Because I have a very strict no assholes policy, because it just takes one rotten. It's all so hard. Filmmaking is so hard that the last thing you need is a difficult personality. And I hadn't, I cast these actors firstly on their ability, but secondly, I looked, I did a lot of research and spoke to people who'd worked with them all in the past and couldn't find anyone who could fault them as humans anywhere. And so, you know, that was a big contribution to their being cast.
Well, that seems like a good policy to have. A no arsehole policy to keep, you know, because I imagine I mean, making a film is a big thing, and it must be a massive team effort. So to have even one rotten apple in the barrel, you know, is going to fuck things up.
Absolutely. For everybody. It's like the mood just spread, because you're all working so closely together and the mood just spreads between everybody. And so it's critical to me. And it's the same with choosing crew members. I don't want any ego. I don't want anyone who's going to speak down to an assistant, because we need the assistants just as much as we need the cinematographer. I've had to replace assistants in the middle of shoots before, like ADs and such, not because we fired them, because they had tragic reasons for having to leave or whatever. And when you get someone new in, just training them up to get them to catch up to where the other person was drastically slows everything down. And so you want to keep everybody on side as much as possible.
Did you bring any of the crew over from Hounds of Love onto this picture?
I tried, but unfortunately it wasn't something that I was able to make happen. So I worked, every single person I worked with, I had never worked with before, which made it a challenge in its own right. Because Hounds of Love I shot in my hometown with a crew who I've been working with for 15 years on TV commercials and music videos and and short films and any number of things. And so they all knew me, they all knew my style, they knew that I wasn't an asshole. Yeah. And so that gave me a sense of confidence. But I'm working with people who are working at the top in Serbia on Extinction. I was working with people who are at the top of their game, who've worked on movies that I love. And so it just made me more intimidated. Like, am I going to say something stupid or, you know, all the insecurities.
Was it somewhat comforting having Emma Booth, the actress from Hounds of Love?
Was a load off because I don't know if you're aware of this, but I met Emma Booth when I was 12 years old, her together opposite each other. And then when we were 20 years old, we acted opposite each other in a TV miniseries. So her and I, and we became really good friends after that. And so her and me have been really good buddies for nearly 20 years. And so having her around was such an emotional rock because I was in Serbia. I don't speak the language. I didn't really know any of the crew that well. So on weekends, just to have someone who I could go and have a coffee with and speak honestly to was a huge load off.
Was there any particular reason? I mean, again, I'm not sure if this goes into plot spoilers or what, but was there any particular reason why the production decided to film in Serbia?
The simple answer is, like, they have great tax breaks. Mm-hmm. So it's your dollar goes a very long way over there. But secondly, we didn't have a lot of money and we were a science fiction film. And so we couldn't build as many sets as we wanted to. And so it was very important to me that we had the background of a city that audiences weren't familiar with seeing, because that was going to give the film a real sense of difference. And we looked at a number of places in Eastern Europe, and Serbia has just got such a unique set of architecture in it that it was, that was a big reason.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was also wanting to talk about, we've already talked somewhat about Hounds of Love, but we'll talk a bit more about that. It was your feature debut. Came out here in the UK last year. I think it was filmed in 2016. One of, you know, it was up there with my favorite horror films of last year.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Although that's something I was wanting to bring up. There, it's one of those films that it seems is somewhat debated. You know, I see it as a horror film, and I've seen other people say it's a horror film, but there's other people who seem to say it's more of a thriller, or, you know, what would you see it as?
I was amazed to see it get marketed as a horror film and then pop up on horror websites. It was very flattering because I thought that we were making a psychological thriller, because if you look at Hounds of Love, there's almost no violence in it. It's there's a lot of implied violence, but there's not a lot on screen. It's all about the psychological relationships between the characters. And so I very much thought that we were making a psychological thriller. And I fear that horror fans who'd, you know, read reviews on the film may have been disappointed when they actually went and watched it, because I did see on just one blog, someone was just abusing the film because it didn't have enough blood in it. Because they'd seen it on some website promoting it as a horror film, and they had their own ideas about what a horror film was, and Hounds of Love certainly wasn't that. So I can't figure out whether it being accidentally embraced as a horror film helped the film or hurt the film.
That's interesting. I mean, yeah, it was brought up. It was reviewed on a lot of the big horror sites, from Dread Central to Bloody Disgusting to all those kind of ones. And it's not your traditional horror movie. But I feel like certainly with a lot of the films that have come out recently, they're like Hereditary and Get Out, and the French film Raw that came out last year. I feel like the definition of what is horror has expanded, particularly in the last few years.
I agree, 100%. I think that films like Hereditary are really exciting to me, because horror films, they used to have a rep, like it just used to be assumed that if it was a horror film, it couldn't be any good. And, you know, I think that I look at films like Raw and like Hereditary as elevated, and The Witch as elevated horror. And for me, that's what I want to watch. And generally speaking, I find these films scarier. I don't get scared by a knife-wielding maniac running around hacking people up and seeing lots of blood. When I watch a horror film, I want to be on the edge of my seat. And for me, tension is always about what could happen rather than what does happen. And I think that there's more films that are sort of embracing that approach at the moment, which I love because it's what I want to watch.
I respond to that. I have to say I respond to that as well, that kind of gnawing, kind of gut-wrenching feeling, the kind of hacking people up is, you know, has its place in within the,
yeah,
the genre, but yeah, it's not something that kind of scares me or unnerves me, whereas a lot of these films really, you know, they're nerve jangling and they do have you on the edge of your seat and you do kind of thinking, oh, what's going to happen, and a lot of it's implied and you don't get the kind of that kind of release of tension that like a big bloody scene actually gives an audience.
I agree. And I think that more and more they're becoming character based rather than situationally based. Mm. Like a lot of the films from the 90s and from the 80s, they had a great hook or they had a great villain or whatever. And then it was about, all right, how can we get this person out there and chop as many people up as possible? And they do that, but they weren't actually that frightening. Whereas films like Hereditary and The Witch, they really get you inside the character's head. And so you're able to experience these, you know, otherworldly situations through the character's eyes, which I think gives you a more honest experience as an audience member. And that's personally what I chase. I want to experience what the character is experiencing when I watch something, you know, but I want to experience it from the comfort of my lounge room chair, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Film itself, The Hounds of Love, The Cat, is a very character-based film, and the central three characters, Vicky, who is kidnapped by this couple, John and Evelyn White, they're all, you definitely get to see into the psychology of each character, and I have to say that the performances by the three actors are really, really amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really nice of you to say. I'm humbled.
It's yeah, I mean, particularly the, I would say particularly Emma Booth as Evelyn is probably the standout, even though each of the characters is
yeah, I think Emma was spectacular, I think, and she didn't go unrecognized on the awards circle, which I thought was really good.
I saw that the film was nominated for a bunch of the ACTA, is that what it's called, ACTA Awards?
Yeah, it was nominated for 9 ACTA Awards, which are, you know, the Australian BAFTA or the American Academy Awards. It was up for 9, and it only won 1, but that was Emma's Best Actress Award.
One of the things I was also impressed with was the kind of, there is obviously a version of this film that could be very tawdry and very sensationalist, but you kind of steered away from that. And, you know, like you said, there's the violence there, but most of it's implied violence. And I take it that was a very deliberate choice.
Yeah, it was, because I mean, the implied violence, what we imply going on, is pretty hideous, and it's not something that I personally want to watch on screen, and I would hope that not anyone wanted to watch on screen. And so I realized very early that I wanted to make a film about the characters who commit particular acts, not a film about the particular acts themselves. And had I shown exactly what was going on in detail, it would have distracted from anything else. And I don't think that you would have got as good an understanding of the dynamics that was going on between the characters. And so it was a choice that we made very early on. And also myself, I read a book before I made this film. I've forgotten what it was called, but essentially the premise of the book was it examined 9 real life couples who'd committed these crimes. And just the idea of sensationalizing stuff that had happened in real life, or, you know, similar events to what happened in real life, just made me feel icky. And so I wanted to avoid that as much as I could.
There seems to be quite a few kind of nasty psychological thrillers to come out of Australia. I mean, apart from your film, there's also things like Snowtown and stuff like that. Is there a particular Australian thing there?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think that there's a few factors that come into that. Firstly, we never get any money to make films over here. So we have to come up with ideas that'll be cheap. And these kind of nasty films that are about characters, well, they're always set in shitty suburbs where you can find locations really easily that aren't going to cost you very much. And they all have limited locations. And so just on a practical sense, they're more affordable to make. But then on a more psychological sense, Australia is a very small place, and nearly everybody, certainly in Western Australia, but even people I've spoken to in Victoria, I'm really good friends with the writer of Snowtown, and I've spoken to him about this as well. Kind of everybody who we meet in Australia is 2 degrees of separation away from someone who was involved in a really horrible event like this, just because we've got a small population. And so I think that it's something that our audiences have an eerie fascination with because it feels so close to home.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I also read about the film was, I was not familiar with the case, but I hear that a lot of Australian critics and the audience in Australia saw a lot of references to the Burnie couple case in your film. And it seems that the movie was somewhat controversial due to that in, you know,
it was Australia. It was. I found that kind of, I think I inevitably knew that mm-hmm. was going to happen because that was a crime that took place in Western Australia. But ironically, it's not actually one of the crimes that I even read about when I was making this film. They weren't one of the couples who featured in the book. Mm. And so I never spoke about them or anything like that, but it was some people in Western Australia who decided that it was about that, and never saw the film and went on a bit of a rampage about it. And I think ultimately ended up embarrassing themselves, because when they came out and criticized me in public, a lot of people came up in my defense and said, well, you know, it's really not that similar. And I don't know how it can be, because there's been nothing really written about that case ever. So it's hard to borrow from a story which you don't know anything of other than the paper. Yeah.
Did that upset you, that so many the people who kind of came out and attacked you, or did you just kind of brush it off?
Not really, because I mean, I think that it means that the film was garnishing a response, which was good. And it means that for a tiny little independent art house film in Australia, you know, it was nice that people, it was generating discussion. But I had far more support for the film than I had criticism. I had literally, you know, if you look at the support I had for the film versus the criticism, I'm not even exaggerating when I say it was about 90% support, 10% criticism. And you're going to have haters for whatever you do, you know, and that's always it. And I think that it's just people in Australia don't like seeing other people succeed for whatever reason it is. And, you know, so Paul, tall poppy syndrome as much as anything. And so it doesn't really bother me. It's something that I've been told I need to get used to.
Yeah, that's interesting. it sounds like Australian culture is very much like British culture, where nobody likes to see anybody succeed in the UK either.
it could be like that. But I mean, I was just thinking about it then. The only criticism I ever got was in Western Australia. it wasn't even at a national level. It was just in my own hometown, which was even more interesting because, you know, I don't feel like I did anything wrong. And in fact, I know I didn't do anything wrong. And so, you know, I certainly didn't promote the names of any real life serial killers or, you know, exploit anyone's story. So I just feel like the hater's going to hate.
Yeah, for sure. I absolutely agree. And yeah, I think, like I say, I mean, there's obviously a version of this movie that could be more tawdry and sensationalist, but it's a restrained, psychologically grounded film. And I can't see why people would.
I think the thing that's also very interesting to me is just, you know, I haven't really spoken about this before, and so I'm putting it all together as I speak about it. Is the other thing that people need to remember is that this movie was marketed as a piece of fiction. There's nothing at the front of it calling it this is a true story. And a big part of the reason why I didn't want to tell a true story, even though I knew that there were 9 of these that I'd found, and I've subsequently discovered more, I didn't want to tell a true story because movies don't work like true stories. Movies have to have some form of redemption. And in Hounds of Love, I asked the audience to empathize and understand a little bit with Evelyn. And I saw no evidence in any of the real life cases that I studied that any of these killers deserved any empathy whatsoever. And so that's why, you know, to these people who are hating or whatever and saying I'm glorifying serial killers, well, I'm not, because I made a piece of fiction. And it's not a documentary. I'm not even calling it a true story in the marketing of it. It's a movie, and it's winning competitions in narrative fiction around the world. And so I think that that's, you know, another important thing that people need to, you know, wake up to.
that's true. And there is other movies that have done that as kind of a hook, you know, the kind of based on true events as kind of a kind of hook for the audience. I'm talking about Australian films. Wolf Creek did that.
Yeah, and Wolf Creek isn't a true story, I'll have you know. Wolf Creek is about as true a story as Fargo is. But it still had people up in arms about it. And it's a fair hook. And look, I do just want to say that I don't have a problem with people making true stories either, because it just seems to be this weird thing that every time someone makes a story about a true crime, people get up and they call it exploitation. They get all angry about it. But no one fucking says anything when a newspaper writes an article about a true crime. At the end of the day, the newspaper is, you know, using the byline of a true crime to make money, to sell a paper, exactly the same way that movies are doing it. And so it's just a lot of these people, these anti-true crime stories, they just need to wake up and realize that every newspaper article ever written on the crime, every television news report ever written on the crime, every book ever written on the crime, at the end of the day, it's all about money. And so I just don't really have a lot of time for people who are going to criticize movies for, you know, people who make movies about real life events, but not criticize other media, because it's all about capital at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very interesting that there is that disconnect between, like, you know, this is exploitative because it's a movie about a true crime, but this is okay because it's a documentary that has a reconstruction of a true crime, which is, you know, the same.
Absolutely. Thing. Absolutely. And a documentary is made for the same reason that a movie is made. They're all commercial, you know, they're all commerce. A documentary, like, there was, you know, a documentary on a true crime, probably, pick any one, probably made more money than Hounds of Love. But yet I'm the one who's exploiting a true crime. You know, it's ridiculous.
It's, yeah, it's very true. But no, I mean, you made a great film, and yeah,
it's an interesting debate. I kind of like having had the opportunity to talk about it, to be honest.
Well, that's great. I'm glad I've given you that opportunity on the show. I also saw an interview with you when you were talking about Hounds of Love. And you were saying, before you got Hounds of Love off the ground, you wrote a bunch of feature screenplays, like something like 7 feature screenplays that you've got kind
I
of.
I think Hounds of Love was actually, yeah, I think Hounds of Love was like my ninth screenplay that I wrote, and none of them ever got up. One of them got very close and then fell over at the last minute. So it was, I mean, the thing that I do truly believe is that I am absolutely talentless, but I just want to make movies more than anything in the world. And so I just realized very quickly that I was absolutely talentless. This is when I was at film school, and I managed to go through film school, I think, without, you know, with only a handful of lecturers even knowing my names, because I was that average a student. And I realized, I looked at all the talent in the room and I thought, right, okay, this guy is making one short film this year and he's really talented. I'm probably going to have to make five before I make one, which is as good as his one. And so I just went out there and wrote and wrote and wrote and filmed stuff and filmed stuff and filmed stuff. And I made so much bad stuff, but I learned so much doing it. And so, yeah, that was really just what I had to do. It's just so competitive that to get any good at it, you just have to do it over and over and over again. You need to hurry up and fail.
Were those scripts like a variety of different genres and different things, or was it more in the kind of thriller arena, thriller horror arena, like Hounds of Love, or just a white
script? The first one I ever wrote was a heist movie, which was really dark. Then I wrote a romantic comedy, and then I wrote a very dark psychological thriller, and pretty much stayed in that genre ever since. And although after Hounds of Love, I wrote a kids film, believe it or not, which I'm still working on. And I'm also working on another science fiction film, which is really dark. So I tend to be drawn to darkness just because it kind of, you know, inevitably involves more complex characters, and that's what I'm interested in. Right. Seeing with people deal with difficult situations and have to make hard decisions.
I mean on this horror podcast, that's the kind of thing we like, you know.
Yeah, good. Good. Well, hopefully I won't disappoint you in the future.
I'm certainly looking forward to it. I enjoyed Hounds of Love. I'm certainly looking forward to checking out Extinction. And
what do you want to know?
Can you tell us any more about the projects you're working on now? You were saying you were on a sci-fi picture, another sci-fi picture.
Yeah, I'm writing a big science film, science fiction film, which takes place in space. And after humanity was wiped out, a handful of survivors ended up on a base just outside of Earth and are torn with the dilemma of, do we get back to Earth and risk, you know, the horrors that are down there, or do we stay in this very controlling dictatorship that we're living in, this small community outside of here? That's called 3182, The Future Is Us. And I'm kind of two thirds of the way through my second draft of the first draft at the moment. And that's my latest one. And that's really dark. And the other one that I'm writing is called Dylan Smith and The Mystery of the Dakota Diamonds, which is very much, an ode to a Goonies type story. A bunch of kids living in tropical northern Western Australia find a map to a real life historical treasure, which has never been found and is somewhere lost up in crocodile country in northwestern Australia. And so I'm working on that one too.
And will these both be see you back in Australia, or is it going to be
a production? So the future is us. I think is something which will have to be shot in, that'll probably be shot in the UK, I imagine. All the characters are American, but if I ever get the film up and you see it out there, you'll understand why it needed to be shot in the UK. And the other one is set very much in Australia, and the Australian landscape is very much a part of it. So that one, if we get it up, will have to be done here.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Intriguing. They both sound interesting. They sound pretty fun. The other one sounds like it could be pretty dark, but well, I'm definitely intrigued by that.
It's really dark. It's probably the most commercial venture that I've ever made. Well, that and the kid. Actually, in fact, both of these are probably the most commercial ventures that I've ever made. But I've really got an interest now. It's just to get films up like Hounds of Love is just so difficult. And the irony that I'm kind of finding now is no one wants to make a little film with me anymore. Everyone wants to do a bigger one. And so that's the I've got another script which I absolutely love, which is called The Unloved, which is about a 15-year-old girl who runs off with two guys who've escaped from a prison in Louisiana, and one of them's on a suicide mission to kill his father, and it's a love story between this girl and this guy who's hell-bent on revenge, and I love it, and it's brutal, but everyone's too scared of it, and they're too scared of doing a film that little, because it's a low budget one, and even though I think the script is great, and I seem to be getting acknowledged a lot for the script, no one wants to make it. They'll go, yeah, but what's your bigger idea? It's like, oh, I want to make little stuff that I want to watch.
You talked a little bit ago about being in film school and deciding that, you know, I've just got to go out there and work as hard as I can and make, you know, five shorts compared to that guy's one short. When you were in film school, what were your kind of particular inspirations? Did you have any particular kind of cinematic director heroes, or were you just like, I'm going to make my own path? And
that didn't come till later, because when I was at film school, I actually didn't want to be a director. I wanted to be an actor and a writer, because I started acting, as I touched on before, when I was 12 years old for screen, and that's what I wanted to do. And so I didn't do any practical filmmaking units while I was at film school. I only did writing units. And part of that logic was, I just, like, with technology getting so much more accessible, and it's so much more accessible even now, everyone was just getting a big hard-on for what technology they could get their hands on and how good they could make something look. And I just kind of thought to myself, well, the technology is getting so much better, so much quicker. What's the point in wasting 3 years learning something which I'm going to have to relearn? You know, I ended up getting really good later on Final Cut Pro. And now, of course, Final Cut's completely changed, and the new Macs won't even run Final Cut 7 anymore. So I don't even know how to edit, because that's all I ever did it on. I know the principles of it. And so I just did screenwriting when I was at uni, because I figured out that the one thing which was never really going to change was story. And it hasn't, you know, even today in screenwriting classes, you're taught that Casablanca is one of the greatest screenplays ever written. And so I figured that the earlier I could get my head around story, the better. And I actually think that that gave me a head start from a lot of other people who I went to film school with, because they were just in a hurry to go out and shoot pretty pictures and then cut this thing together. And they'd shoot beautiful shots, but there was just no meaning behind any of them. And there was no story behind any of them. And so, so while I did shoot a lot of stuff, I spent most of my time focusing on the actual crafting of a story. Because that never changes.
No, that's very true. I can't, you know, technology changes all the time, but it, like you say, there's certain kind of touchstone kind of classic scripts that are still seen as the kind of very top. Casablanca, you mentioned, things like Chinatown, as you know.
Ah, yeah. And you know, in our genre, like Silence of the Lambs, like part of why I made Hounds of Love was I longed for those kind of psychological horror / thriller films that we were getting quite a lot of in the 90s and early noughties. Yeah. And they just kind of dried up, you know, the smartest thriller, and that's what I want to watch. And I just found myself every time I was wanting to watch a scary movie or a more confronting movie, I'd always turn back to Seven or Silence of the Lambs or, you know, something from around then. And I thought, before Denis Villeneuve came along and did Prisoners, there really wasn't anything that was sophisticated and of genre that was coming out. I'm glad to see that's changing now, though.
Yeah, it does seem to be there's picking up momentum, both in terms of what we're talking about earlier of what is described as quote-unquote elevated horror and more kind of in-depth psychological thrillers coming out in the last kind of probably 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
it seemed to be a big boon for that in the 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did it well.
Yeah. I mean, Silence of the Lambs and Seven, both classic films. Were they films that you looked to when filming Hounds of Love?
Totally, absolutely. Mostly, you know, not so much for style, but certainly for structure. And another one, of course, is The Shining, Kubrick's The Shining. Yeah. But I loved, like, tonally, the films back then were just more consistent. And also, character-wise, they were much more consistent. So I looked at those films for, you know, the structure of character art more than anything. I don't think I borrowed so much from them stylistically, although I probably did subconsciously. But certainly, as far as, like, how do you put interesting characters with interesting human dilemmas into a genre film? And so that's why I looked at those kind of movies, or those specific ones.
Yeah. I mean, your movie, The Hounds of Love, definitely looks different. It looks kind of real. You know, there's the Silence of the Lambs and Seven both have a kind of highly stylized look to them.
Yeah, they're a bit slick.
Yes. They're very polished, polished looking productions, whereas...
Yeah. Yeah, Hounds is uglier. I think that the contemporary films that I drew most from Hounds were Monster and Snowtown.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're ugly. And, you know, the films kind of aesthetically feel like the characters that they're representing. And that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely that element to it. And again, there seems to be a few kind of Australian films like that, like Snowtown. And although it's a different, it's more just a kind of crime thriller, something like Animal Kingdom as well, that has that kind
absolutely.
Of
absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Grungy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's the best word for it, grungy. That's nails it.
Yeah, I love it. I love that word.
Well, I think that's... What was that?
I was just going to say cinematographers hate it when you're sitting down with the cinematographer and they're like, how do you want it to look? And I go, I want it to look ugly. I don't care if we can't see everyone's eyes properly. If they've got dark rings under there, it's got to look ugly. And they hate that. And they always agree with you, but then they always end up bringing out 90,000 lights and putting sparkles in everyone's eyes. But, you know, they got to do that. They do their thing.
Yeah. That was another thing that I saw in an interview of yours where you, in Hounds of Love, you thought that there was going to be something like 15 effect shots. And it turned out there was like 200 or something.
Oh, God, something like that. I was very naive, I think. So they weren't really, you know, no fancy effect shots, but it was all just painting stuff out. So it was little stuff like the court that the girls are playing netball on at the beginning of the film. Well, they were all asphalt in the 80s and they're all green now. And so we had to, of course, change the color of that in post-production. And then inevitably a modern car would drive past in the background down a street that gets used like once a year, but of course they're going to do it the minute that we're rolling. And so it was all just little cleanups like that. Nothing really special, but stuff that took a lot of time and was really boring, I imagine, for the people doing it. Lots of rotoscope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our interview. It's been very nice talking to you.
Lovely speaking to you, Scott. Yeah, thank you so much for asking intelligent questions.
Well, thanks for complimenting the quality of my questions. That's very nice of you.
No worries. I thought they were really good. It was a very refreshing change.
Well, I look forward to seeing Extinction when it comes out at the end of July. And your future projects, the 3028, this is the future? Is that the future is ours?
Yeah, 3182, The Future is Us.
3182, The Future is Us. Okay.
Yep, that's it. So 82, meaning, you know, we started the measurement of time again because the world ended. So we're in the second AD.
I see.
Yes.
Well,
I early days on that one.
And if you're filming in the UK, maybe we'll have another interview then, have you back on the show.
That sounds great. Thank you very much, and good luck with everything.
Well, that was my guest, Ben Young there, who I'd like to thank very much for being on the show. And not just because he complimented me on my line of questioning, but just because I felt like it was a great interview. And hopefully you too, listener, felt that way and enjoyed this latest episode of New Horror Express. Now, if you did enjoy this latest episode, it'd be great if you could head on over to iTunes or Stitcher and give us a rating and a review. If you didn't enjoy it, just move on. You know, just don't bother. It's fine. It's okay. But, you know, as an independent podcast, every little helps. And any thoughts you have would be most welcome. You can always also give us a like on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Anyway, that's all for this month's episode of New Horror Express. Please do tune in next month, where we talk to director Brett Simmons.